name is Tim Albinson. Thank you for the introduction, Bill. Thank you guys for inviting me to come down and spend a little bit of time with you. I live in San Francisco, and I woke up at 4 a.m. this morning in New York City. So if I look like I'm a little jet lagged, it's probably because I am. But having a chance to speak to you guys was a great opportunity. So I rearranged my flights, and here I am. So it's really great to be here. And we're going to, I don't know what your other lectures here in this series have been like, but this is going to be, I hope, a slightly different one. My goal is not to sort of pontificate or talk about theories or talk about technology trends as much as it is to share with you a bunch of the lessons that I've learned from the front lines. And I've been in the trenches, as it were, for about 6.5 years building a technology company. And you know, it's a hand-to-hand combat kind of an existence. I've taken a bunch of my learnings and summarized them or consolidated them into a course, as Bill mentioned, that I teach at the UC Berkeley Extension up in San Francisco. And we do eight classes, of 3 hours each, and each class is on a specific topic. You know, how do you validate your idea, your concept as a topic? How do you raise money, and what's a financing strategy? How do you build out your team? So what I've done for this lecture is condense that into about a 45-minute presentation. So I'm going to roll through that presentation, and then I want to leave a lot of time for questions, because my assumption coming in, and maybe we can do a show of hands, is that many people here want to start companies after they leave school. How many people are interested in starting their own company at some point? Okay, perfect, perfect. So, you know, hopefully at least one bullet point or tidbit in this 45-minute presentation or so will resonate with you, and you can take that. If you can just take that one tidbit and say, wow, that piece resonated with me, and I'm going to tuck that away in the back of my head, and I'm going to use that strategy as I go out to build my business, then I will have done my job tonight. So, you know, there'll be a bunch of my learnings and lessons in here, but as we go through the presentation, take notes, think about what, you know, this might mean for you, or what issues might resonate for you, and then the Q&A part will hopefully be really interactive. So I alluded to this a bit a second ago. You know, what is this talk about? You know, this is a pragmatic, street level, you know, you're in the trenches kind of a talk. We're not going to be talking about, you know, Venn diagrams and theories, and, you know, textbooks and lectures on theory have their place, and that's what you spend a lot of your time doing here. But what I do every day is push a rock up a hill. You know, I go out, I wake up every morning, and I push a rock up a hill, and sometimes the rock rolls down and it hits me, and sometimes I get it up an inch or two, and I get, you know, a little bit further in my plan. And I've been doing this for 6 or 7 years, so I'm trying to share the real, you know, the real hard lessons that I've learned with you guys, and hopefully, again, it'll help you as you think through what you're going to do in the next phase of your careers. The goal is actionable takeaways, again, not theoretical takeaways. So here's a quick agenda. Again, this is largely pulled from the course that I teach up in San Francisco. I don't need to read through each of these bullet points. You could read them for yourselves. We'll go through each one of these in a series of a couple of slides. And, you know, again, this is just sort of a soup to nuts talk on a number of the very important buckets that you need to think about when you're going to start a company, ranging from your idea all the way through how do I consider exiting, all the way through what kind of culture is my company going to have, how do I finance the thing, what does operations even mean, what kind of organizational behavior strategies do I want to have in place so that my people are as motivated as they can be. So this is all important stuff, and a lot of times, you know, people think, you know, you invent kind of a cool technology and then the rest of it takes care of itself. And sometimes that actually does happen in the world. Sometimes people create a neat technology and some VCs come in and they say, look, this is a great technology and we're going to take this thing public in 18 months. And that's a great story when it happens. But unfortunately, the reality is it usually takes 5 or 10 years of pushing the rock up the hill. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. So who am I? My name again is Tim Albinson. I'm from Washington, D.C. originally. I have a very diverse background. One of the big lessons of entrepreneurship is that you don't need to be a technologist, you don't need to be a business person. I have an English lit undergrad, I have a Berkeley MBA, I've worked in the software business, I've been an investment banker at Goldman Sachs, I was a writer for the Washington Post sports page making $12,000 a year. I was a nonprofit environmentalist for 5 years and started a company living in Ecuador doing Amazon conservation work. So, you know, very broad background, and I'm 37 years old. So I've spent about 10 years of my working career in the software business, but you know, you don't need to have any, there's no blueprint for being an entrepreneur, none whatsoever. You could come from any field in the world and say, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring, I'm going to go for it, I'm going to make something happen. And you don't need a specific background. You partner with people that have specific backgrounds. I don't know the first thing about what I'm gathering, given the school that I'm in here, what most of you are very strong in, which is engineering. I'm not an engineer. I call myself the non-technical CEO. But I've got some of the brightest folks working for me that know this stuff. So you put good people in place around you, and you don't need to have any specific skill set other than a lot of heart. The company that I run is called Aravo Solutions. I started the company in 2000, February of 2000. If anybody remembers February of 2000, it was about 6 weeks before April of 2000. And April of 2000 is when the NASDAQ dove about 500 points. And the good old days were over. So I got about 6 weeks of the good old days. I left Goldman Sachs in February of 2000 and got a quick call from my grandmother saying that she thought I was a complete idiot for walking away from a firm like that to start a software company. And 6 weeks later, she called me back again and said, "See, I told you so." But now she calls me and she says, you know, she's very proud of me, so that's good. We've all got to keep our grandmothers happy. That's an important part of the puzzle. So I started the company. Initially, the company was called Exchange Wave. I think I've got a fancy laser pointer here somewhere. Put somebody's eye out with this thing. Exchange Wave. Exchange Wave was going to be a barter platform. When I was at Goldman, I was a bond trader, and I was in the fixed income currencies and commodities group. And the first thing I learned about the bond markets is that there's no physical trading floor. There's no place where the guys are shouting out with the pieces of paper and they're calling like you see on TV. That's the commodities trading pit. And I didn't know that. I figured there had to be one for the bond markets and the stock markets. And I quickly found that the bond markets really existed through a series of very complex and extensive IT and telecom systems, telecommunications. It's all virtual. It's a virtual marketplace. It's the biggest market in the world besides real estate. And I thought that was fascinating. I'm like, this is all telephones and IT systems. At the same time, as I'm having these light bulbs go off, there were companies, some of which you may have heard of, Ariba, Commerce One, i2, these are all supply chain enterprise software technology companies. Free Markets was a very exciting one, I thought. Free Markets was a reverse auction company. These guys were all going public. So you know, being inside Goldman Sachs, I got to read all the reports on the inside about these companies that were going public, and they were talking about changing the world. And what the dots that I saw being connected was what they were saying was, we're going to take all these technologies that you currently see in the bond markets, these IT systems, these telecom systems, these very, very complicated software tools, and we're going to apply them to old line industries like trucking, manufacturing, what have you. And I thought that was just wildly, wildly interesting, much more interesting than selling bonds. So I quit, and I started a company called Exchange Wave, and what we were going to do at Exchange Wave was build a barter platform. Many of the companies that I just rattled off, they were selling marketplace software. And those were the B2B exchange days, if any of that rings a bell. You guys may or may not have heard about that sort of phenomenon, but back in 1999 and 2000, every day of the week, there was another B2B exchange popping up. Some guy was doing remotecontrols.com and papercups.com, and they were going to disintermediate the supply chain of the paper cup industry and make a killing and go public in, you know, 12 months. And it all sounded like it made sense, but it never really happened that way. So, you know, as I looked at my own market timing, it was terrible. It couldn't have been worse. It really couldn't have been worse. We were smart enough to quickly change our strategy, and I'll talk about that in a bit when we get to the slide on the idea. But timing is everything, and ours was just terrible. It was terrible. I was sitting in San Francisco about 2 months after quitting Goldman going, what have I done? The markets are crashing. I'd raised a little bit of money, but we didn't have any technology. We were years away from sales. But you can survive tough markets if you've got great investors and if you've got a great team. And we had both of those things. Despite not spending that long on Wall Street, I met a lot of great folks there and managed to involve them in my company. And today we have CEOs and CFOs from most of the top investment banks are our investors. And they stuck with us through 5 or 6 years of very, very tough markets. So if you've got great investors and you've got a persistent mentality, the last bullet point here, you know, I say this all the time, persistence is part of our business model at Aravo. You've just got to get up and push the rock up the hill every day. It's a big part of being an entrepreneur. And the good news is if you do that, eventually the markets will come back. Markets always come back. I mean, I remember coming out of high school, or let me think about this. Yeah, high school in 87, and the markets were great. That was the yuppie days. If you know, I don't know how many people here remember that, but that was the yuppie days. And then they died, and I came out of college in 92, and there were no jobs anywhere. It's terrible. I came out of college in 92, and guys from Harvard and Yale were working for free in Washington, D.C., just to get jobs. And I was like, how am I going to compete with that? Then mid-90s, not so good again. Late 90s, great again. 2000, 2001, terrible, and now they're back again. So if you just hold on, it's going to come back. That's a big part of being an entrepreneur, is just having the faith that no matter how bad things might look at a given time, it's going to come back. So that persistence is a cornerstone of our business model, and it's got to be a cornerstone of your business model if you want to start a company. So I'm going to give you guys a couple slides on my company now, just so you have a sense for what we do. I gather there are a lot of technologists in the room, so probably have, you know, some people are probably curious about what we do. We're 6 years old. We've raised about $12 million. We have about 25 employees. We have 6 channel partners, 25 customers. I'm not going to read each of these bullet points. You can read them. I think the key is the sixth bullet point. The sixth bullet point is that we have a lot of momentum right now, and we have survived a really tough couple of years, and the markets have come back. We didn't have any clients 2002, 2003, but now we count IBM, Oracle, Accenture, et cetera, among our clients and channel partners. And this notion of channel partners is something that I'll come back to when we get to the sales and marketing slide. You've really got to think through how you're going to sell your product. And one caveat, this presentation is inevitably going to be somewhat skewed to a software company because that's what we do. There are going to be some things that are just different if you're building a chip company or a hardware company, but a lot of the stuff's going to be the same. But just the one caveat is it's going to skew a little bit towards the software markets. So what do we do? Aravo is a supplier information management company. How many people are familiar with Salesforce.com? Okay, so Salesforce.com is a CRM company. It's called Customer Relationship Management. They sit between Caterpillar. Don't look at the diagram for a second. Think CRM. They sit between Caterpillar and their customers. So Caterpillar is the internal company. There's a software tool that sits between Caterpillar and its customers, and Caterpillar's sales execs use that Salesforce tool to interact more effectively with their customers, drive more revenue, capture efficiencies. Aravo is the opposite. We sit between Caterpillar and their suppliers. That's SRM, Supplier Relationship Management. The funny thing is that when Salesforce came out, they were wildly successful, and they defined the CRM market. So everyone said, well, geez, if there's CRM on the sell side for a company, then there's got to be SRM on the buy side for a company. Well, that's just logical, right? Well, it didn't really work that way. So they threw the acronym out there, and a bunch of companies called themselves SRM companies, but they really weren't. And in that sense, we've really helped to define the market. We've actually changed from SRM to supplier information management. And I'll just spend a minute here telling you guys what we do. So here you've got all these suppliers, right? The old way of doing business was that a supplier worked with Caterpillar. Caterpillar would fax over a purchase order. I mean, these are suppliers that supply everything. Again, remote controls, paper cups, Blackberries, chairs, food services, you name it. The old way of doing business was Caterpillar would say, I need, you know, 1 million paper cups. They'd fax over a purchase order. The supplier would say, I got it. They'd acknowledge the purchase order. They'd send over the cups, and they'd send an invoice, and Caterpillar would cut a check. That's the old way of doing business. The new way of doing business, and this is what all of these reports I was reading at Goldman's talked about, was that's all going to happen on the web. all that process I just described, from purchase order to payment, was going to happen on the web. Everybody thought it would take 12 to 18 months, huge tectonic shift, trillions of dollars in savings. Everybody was pumping their fists in the air, we're going to change the world kind of thing, and didn't happen. What did happen was a couple of companies did a phenomenal job of marketing themselves. Ariba and i2 were a couple of the ones I mentioned. And they built good software, and there was some good stuff that happened. But at the end of the day, these changes take decades, not months. And so here we are, 7 years later, and there's still a huge opportunity to do what we do, which is sell tools to Caterpillar that allows them to deploy a software solution, ours, to capture all different types of information from their suppliers that Caterpillar needs in order to electronically transact with those suppliers. So you've got contacts at the suppliers and profile information and content like catalogs, transaction requirements like e-invoicing information and EFT, electronic funds transfer information, diversity certifications. Big companies like Caterpillar get huge tax breaks if they source from women and minority-owned businesses or veteran-owned businesses. But in order to prove that you're a veteran-owned business to Caterpillar, you have to have a diversity certification that's a rubber stamp from a government official that says, yes, this person is, in fact, veteran-owned. It's a real pain in the butt for Caterpillar to gather all that information from their 100,000 suppliers and then feed it into the 106 different systems they've got internally. So on the far right, SAP, Oracle, those are all the types of internal systems Caterpillar uses. We sit in the middle and provide a structure, a framework, for Caterpillar to gather that information, for the suppliers to upload it, to validate it, et cetera. We're a software tool. It's a productivity tool. And we sit between Caterpillar and its suppliers. Real simple. Here are some of our other clients. Our big coup is that Oracle uses us internally, which is a wonderful validation for us. They're a huge software company, obviously, in their own right. They have a lot of tools in our specific area, but we do a great job at that particular niche of supplier information management, so much so that they use us internally, which is great. And a couple other clients here. So that's it on the company background. Just wanted you guys to have a sense for what we do. It's an enterprise software company. Nothing tricky about it. There's thousands of them out there. I bet somebody in this room will start one and do something great. So when you do start that company, when you do found a company, like, what does that mean? What is the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning and you say, gee, I think today's the day I'm graduating from college, or I've just been in this big company for a couple of years. I've learned a lot. I think it's time to go out on my own. You know, what do you do? I always counsel people to ask the question before you jump in with both feet. And this is not to dissuade anybody from ever starting a company. It's been the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I love running my company. But ask yourself, is this the right thing? Be very, very realistic with yourself about whether or not this makes sense for you. Certainly before you quit your job if you're already working, or certainly before you know, take out loans and credit cards and do a lot of the things that us crazy entrepreneurs do. You know, and have a really, really realistic appreciation for the time and energy and commitment that it's going to be required, that's going to be required to succeed. And that's Sisyphus as the figure from Greek mythology who pushes the rock up the hill, and every time he pushes it up, it rolls down, right? I don't know how many of you guys remember that from Greek mythology, but people say, Tim, how you doing? How's the company? My response has been the same for 6 years. I'm still pushing the rock up the hill. And that's, you know, I didn't think when I started the company that I'd be doing that 7 years later. And it's great. I love what I do. We've got a great company, but you got to have an appreciation for the time level, the commitment level, and the time commitment that it's going to take. And it's just go in eyes wide open, because there's other alternatives out there. If you don't want to start a company, if you've got a core technology, for example, that you've developed, you can take an entrepreneurial role within a larger company, go to that company and say, look, I've got this great technology. We should really build out a division around this and sell it. You can get a strategic partner. You can go out and find somebody that's doing similar work and partner with them and take it to market that way. You can be an EIR, which is an entrepreneur in residence. That means you go to a venture capital firm. You say, look, I've got this great technology. I want to be an entrepreneur in residence, which means you get to leverage all of the resources of the venture capital firm and all the network and all the partners and all that kind of great stuff, but you're not taking on quite as much risk as you do when you start your own company. All that said, I say go for it. Start your own company. It's great, but just go in eyes wide open and realize that it's not the only model. There's other ways to achieve your goals. So just, you know, words to the wise. Find a mentor who's been there. Can't stress this enough. Wish I had done it earlier. I had a great mentor, but he was a venture capitalist. He wasn't an entrepreneur with a lot of operating experience. Find somebody that's been there. Find somebody that's graduated from UCSB. Find somebody who's a friend of the family. You know, offer to take him out to dinner. Go talk to him. Find a friend that's been there. Get a mentor. It's, you know, there's no better investment in your time before you start a company than finding somebody who's been there and talking with them about their experiences. I can't stress that enough. When you do go to start your company, get a good law firm. The law firm is key, and it's probably something that you're not going to be able to do on your own. Sometimes I've had people say, oh, I've got this great CD. It's got all these legal forms on it. I paid $19 for it. Think of all the money I just saved. I'm like, you are not saving money. You are losing tons of money. Trust me. Get a good lawyer. The first thing I did when I was starting my company, I was flown out by Goldman to do some recruiting at Haas, my former school, my alma mater. I did the recruiting session in a room like this. Goldman's great. Go to Goldman. Got in my car. Drove down to see one of my former professors, a guy named Mario Rosati, who works for a firm called Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich & Rosati. And I said, Mario, I'm thinking about quitting my job and starting a company. Can you take me on as a client if I do? Because at the time, in 2000, you couldn't get a lawyer. There were so many companies being started that they were not taking on new clients. So that was the first thing that I did. And he said that he would do it because I was a good student and all that kind of stuff. But that's, if you don't have a law firm, you've got a bunch of stuff that needs to be done that you're going to be struggling to get done correctly. Securities, getting your equity and your cap table set up. Your cap table is a capitalization table. That's all your equity. So when you start a company, if it's just you, you own the whole company, right? But you need to set up a capital table. You need to put options aside for your future employees, your future board members, your future board of advisors. There's a large structure called a capitalization table that if you hold it up on the wall, it shows every share in your company, all the options, all the equity, and the lawyers set that up for you. The lawyers do all your filings with the SEC. They do your board book. Every time you do a board meeting, you've got to keep minutes, and they keep that book for you in case there's ever any legal action or discrepancies in the record. They keep that record for you. They keep all the options documents. So every time we hire a new employee, the lawyers do a bunch of paperwork so that that employee has the correct documents so that when, you know, knock on wood, we either go public or get acquired, they cash in those options and the lawyer matches up what the employee has and a check is cut. So very important to have a good law firm. Last point, and this one I think is the most important on the page, it's right up there with find a mentor, is equity is a tool and you should use it to build your company. I can't tell you how many friends I've watched start companies and hoard the equity in the company. Does everybody know what equity is? Anybody not? Okay. I didn't know what it was when I got to business school. Somebody said to me, man, this company is doing a bunch of financing with debt right now. I don't play golf. I remember the conversation because I was invited to play golf, and I am horrible at golf. And he said, yeah, they're financing themselves with debt. I looked at him and said, well, geez, I've got a lot of debt. Can I finance myself? I have credit cards like $20,000. I can finance myself with debt. And he explained to me, no, there's debt, there's equity. Equity is the ownership in your company. It's the stock in your company. A lot of people try to hold on to all the equity. They say, gosh, when this thing goes public, I want to own 100% of it. And that just could not be more backwards. Equity is a tool. You use it to grow your company. When I started my company, I was a lone founder, and that's very rare that it happens that way. So when I went down to see the lawyers, I said, I want to start the company. They said, okay, we're going to capitalize the company with 10 million shares. We're going to put 2 million aside for the employee option pool, and they take 100,000. The lawyers take 100,000 because I couldn't afford to pay them. So you give them 1% of the outstanding equity is the deal that they had at the time that we cut. The other 7.9 million were mine. I was like, yeah, 7.9 million shares, that's great. Well, they're not worth anything, but that's a great big number. that number at the time represented 79% of the company. Today I own less than 20% of the company because every time we bring on new investors, new employees, I get diluted down. But, this fancy laser pointer here, 10% of x is worth a lot more than 100% of 0, all right? So my 16%, if that's the number, right, you know, I think it's right around 15, 16% today. If the company's worth $100 million, well, now I have something that's actually worth $15 million. We're not quite worth $100 million. I'd like that to be true. Hopefully, we will be soon. But if you have 100% of 0, you're dead in the water. And I have lots of friends whose companies went out of business with them holding 100%. And you don't want to be in the 100% of 0 category. Valuation, comparables, expanding pie, dilution, these are all terms around equity. I throw them out there just for you guys to build your vocabulary. Valuation, total number of outstanding shares times price per share gives you the valuation of your company. If you have 10 million outstanding shares and they're priced at 72 cents a piece, your company's worth $7.2 million. Comparables, how do you get to a valuation when you first start your company? Go out and look at other companies doing the same thing that might be a little bit ahead of you, for example. They're a couple of years down the line, they're doing a similar, they've got a similar business model. Because the first time you go to pitch somebody for an investment, they're going to say, what's your valuation? You're going to say, oh, I think $8 million. They say, why? Well, how'd you come up with eight? Why not seven? So you'll say, well, I've analyzed the comparables out there. You know, you're going to sound really smart because you're going to say, here's six comparables. It's just like buying a house. When people go to do an assessment of the house's value, they look at comparables in the neighborhood. It's the same thing. Expanding pie. The expanding pie means, so it's the scenario I just described. I started out with 7.9 million shares. Every time we add investors, we're giving them more shares. The total number of outstanding shares is going up. I'm being diluted because my denominator is increasing while my numerator is staying the same, 7.9 divided by X. Well, X is going up, so I'm being diluted. But the total value of the firm is going up. So that, you know, the expanding pie theory says you continue to add shares, you're getting diluted, but your share value is going up. So actually, your total cash position or the value of your shares should always be going up. So this is another slide around founding the company. This is a real slide that I made in 2000. Late 2000, I put this slide together. And I've shown this slide every investor meeting that I've had with my investors for the last 6 or 7 years. I pull this slide out. And I say, look, this is our plan. And I broke down every year into a one-word description. Found it, develop it, launch it, reference. You can read the rest. This was a roadmap to building the company. And we want to get to the objective at the end of 07 of grow from revenues or be acquired. For reasons I'll get into later when we talk about the exit strategy, I don't think an IPO is for us. I think that we're likely to get acquired in terms of our exit. This has been a very, very helpful slide because I look at it and I say, are we on target? You know, this is about customers here. This is about product here. This is financing down here. So I encourage you, and I'm sure there's some way that you guys will get a hold of this presentation. I'll make sure you do with working with Bill. I encourage you to take a matrix like this or, you know, customize it to your own needs and interests, but do something like this and visualize what you're trying to do. Put some goals out there. You can start small. Start with a two-year matrix and say, here's where I want to be in 24 months. You know, but you can't stay in prototype product if you're ever going to get to that bottom right box, right? You can't stay in develop business plan. You got to keep moving to the right, and you got to be able to chart your progress. And as soon as you start a company, man, things start swirling. Things start moving really, really fast. So it's really great to have something like this to say, how am I doing? Am I on target with what I'm trying to achieve? And the time to plot that map out is when you're clear-headed now while you're students. You know, while you've got the time to say, what am I really trying to be? Where do I want to be when I'm 24? Where do I want to be when I'm 30? Where do I want to be a year or two from now? Put a map like this in place. All right, so the idea. You got great educations, you know, you guys have great heads on your shoulders. What's the idea going to be? You come up with the idea, then how do you know if it's the right idea? What if you have four ideas? You know, what do you do? How do you think about the idea? I went through three different ideas before I quit Goldman and started my company. First one was in the food business, the restaurant business. It was using the internet to do something in the food service industry. I won't bore you with all the details. The second one was in the ticketing industry. And I thought that one was a great idea, and I decided not to do that one. And then there was another one. Then there was the barter platform. The barter platform evolved into the company we're doing today. The top bullet point is one that I hope you guys remember because I think it's really, really important. And as I was arriving today, I saw your magazine here, which is well done magazine, by the way, whoever is responsible for this. The Next Big Things is one of the cover stories here. And I said, well, that's appropriate, because that's one of the main messages I want you guys to think about as you're thinking through your ideas. Sometimes the next big thing is actually making the last big thing work, is the lesson that I've learned. Because everybody's always looking for the next big thing. And that's great. That's innovation. And that's really, really important. But a lot of times these innovations don't work the way they're expected to. And a lot of folks are on to the next big thing. Well, in our case, we're making the last big thing work. That big thing was that transformation from Caterpillar purchasing everything using phone, fax, catalogs, that kind of stuff, to doing it all on the web. That big thing happened in like 1998. People think it's over. It's far from over. It is far from over. Most of these big companies are still doing stuff the old way. But folks think it's over because they're onto the next big thing. So sometimes the next big thing is making the last big thing work right. And that's something to put in your, you know, in your head as you're thinking through, where's a business opportunity for me? Well, go look at some of the last big things and see if there's any of them that really aren't working, and can you fix them? Market entry, you have to have respect for the macro forces. Timing is everything. It's all around you. We all just watched what happened with YouTube, right? Immaculate timing, right? I mean, these guys, talk about knocking the cover off the ball. 18 months from startup to $1.6 billion sale to Google. I mean, that's timing. That's timing. That's how you do it. They made history. That's perfect timing. You can't control these things. There's a lot of luck involved. There's another 200 video sharing sites that didn't make it. You don't hear about them. I actually have a good friend who started one that was sold for $60 million right around the time that YouTube was sold for $1.65. He was wildly successful, but by YouTube standards, he wasn't. Ecos is a company that some friends of mine founded. I put that up there as an example of too early. Ecos was an environmental marketplace that was started back in 1999. And it was going to help companies manage their environmental risks. So DuPont would buy this software tool, and it would help them manage all of their hazardous materials and waste and all that kind of stuff. It was just too early. DuPont was still doing everything with paper. They had other priorities. They were trying to figure out all their, you know, their really core problems, like, you know, supplier relationship and customer relationship. Environmental stuff was just years and years off for them. And unfortunately, my friend's company went out of business because the market just wasn't ready for them. If you look at Exchange Wave, which was my barter idea that I left Goldman to start, that was actually too late. And I was either really gutsy or really stupid, probably the latter, actually, to be quite honest, because there were three companies that launched in January of 2000. They were funded by Kleiner Perkins, which is the premier venture capital firm in the world. They had the CFO of Citibank was their CEO, and these were barter platforms, and yet I still decided to throw my hat into the ring and try to compete with these guys, which was completely moronic, quite frankly. I mean, it couldn't have been a worse decision. I was too late. There was a better funded platform out there that was already up and running and live. So that was one of the reasons we switched strategies a couple months into our process. We were too late. So another thing to think about when you're thinking about your idea is, what kind of company are you? And the way that venture capital firms look at the world is, there's really two kinds of companies. And that's an overstatement. There's lots of kinds of companies. But there are two buckets that you can largely categorize companies into. One is better, faster, smarter. And that's what we do at Aravo. We provide a software tool that allows companies to save money by increasing productivity with working with their suppliers. It's better. It's faster, it's smarter. You use technology to replace manual tasks that human beings are otherwise doing, which costs money. So it's just like saying, in the old days, people on Wall Street used to do spreadsheets by hand, and now they use Excel. Excel is better, faster, smarter. Then there's Brave New World. Brave New World is Google. Brave New World is, I've just invented a technology that just didn't exist a year ago. It does something that no other technology does. Google has algorithms that allows them to search better than Yahoo or the other companies they were competing with. It was a brave new world company. So they invented something completely new. This breaks down into productivity tools, which again is Aravo versus core technologies, which is Google. In terms of your business model and your go-to-market strategy, are you going to sell picks and shovels or are you going to mine for gold? When we were starting Aravo, we were going to mine for gold. We were going to start that barter marketplace. We were going to be the site. We were going to be a destination site and have people come in there and trade and run transactions. We were going to be the site. That's mining for gold. We switched strategy and said, hey, let's not mine for gold. Let's recognize that there's all these other miners out there, all these other exchanges. Let's sell them picks and shovels so they can go mine for gold. You can be one or the other. You're probably not going to be both. So get a sense for whether you're better, faster, smarter, or brave new world, whether you're a productivity tool or a core technology, whether you're selling picks and shovels or whether you're mining for gold, because this is going to help you refine your idea, refine your go-to-market strategy. It's going to impact the kind of VCs you go after. There are VCs that are going to say, look, we don't fund productivity tools. We only fund core technologies. And you just don't want to waste your time going to the VCs that are inappropriate. So financing. This is probably one of the more interesting slides for folks like you, because I imagine if you have an idea, one of your questions is, where do I get the money to do this? And that's a good question. It's one of the hardest parts of the process. There's three types of financing I'd like to talk about. Angel financing, venture capital, and strategic investment. So the first is angel investing. Angels are great. Angels are your best friends if you're trying to start a company. We have financed almost all of our $12 million in capital through angel investors. It's been a great model for us. Why do angels invest? I always say they invest for sport. A lot of these angel investors are very wealthy. They have 95% of their portfolio in conservative investments. They have 5% that they play around with. If you can be part of that 5%, it's great. Why? Because they're more hands-off than VCs and strategic investment partners. They're very supportive of you because you're out there doing it. You're out there representing them. You're trying to make them successful. You're trying to make them money. You represent a large potential return. And they do what we call spray and pray, meaning they invest in a lot of companies, because if they hit one, it's going to make up for the 20 that don't hit. So they say, look, I'm going to fund 20 people that I think are really smart, that have good business ideas, and if one of them is YouTube or Google or even a company that has a liquidity event at 10% of those numbers, it's going to make up for the other, whatever, 19 or however many it is that don't hit. Why do VCs invest? I skipped camaraderie. Camaraderie is important. One of the things we've done at Aravo is build out a network of people that know each other. So now we have investor dinners where there's 20 people and they're all friends. They like to be in this together. It's fun. These are all very wealthy people. They say, oh, yeah. They like to, fire off questions and put me on the hot seat and, enjoy roasting the entrepreneur a little bit. It's camaraderie. I think that they enjoy it. And that's important. And if you know that, when we get down here to pitching, know the why and the how follows, remember that camaraderie piece, because that's very important, understanding why people invest. So why do VCs invest? Well, VCs are investing to try to pick the next billion-dollar businesses. It's very, very simple. These guys do it for a living. They're looking for the next Google. They're looking for the next Apple. One of the questions that drove me crazy when I was pitching VCs was, tell me why you're going to be the next billion-dollar business. And I often said, well, so it wouldn't be good enough if I was a $400 million business? That seems, if you put in $4 million and we sold for $400 million, that's not too bad, huh? They want the billion-dollar businesses. And that's a generalization. There certainly aren't. It's certainly not a situation where all of them will require that you can justify the likelihood that you'll be a billion-dollar business. But a lot of these guys do. Because why is it? Because they don't make that many investments. They make a couple of investments a year. You're a partner at a VC. You might do two investments a year. Not only are you going to put tons of time into doing all the due diligence and structuring the deal, your butt's on the line. If those businesses don't do well, you might not be asked to join the next fund. So they're very, very careful about the investments they make. They put you through 4-6 months of due diligence. Some companies move very fast, but for the most part, you're in for a long due diligence cycle. The 1 in 10 theory is very similar to the spray and pray, in that they know that or they expect that in their model, 1 in 10 will hit and will pay for the other 9 that fail. And you have to remember that the LPs, which are limited partners, are the clients of the VCs. So the VCs have their own set of drivers. They have limited partners. So if you're a venture capital firm and you've raised a $1 billion fund, you have limited partners that have invested that money. Those limited partners might be university endowments. They might be pension funds. The California Public Employees Pension Fund, CalPERS, is a huge investor in venture capital. They've got hundreds of billions of dollars, and a lot of it goes to venture capital. So you've always got to bear in mind that the VCs are they're great resources for young companies, but they also have their own clients, the LPs, and sometimes VCs have to make decisions that benefit the LPs, and that might be shutting your business down. If they don't believe that you're going to make it, they may shut your business down. They might roll you up, or they might not give you more money if that's what you need. So go in eyes open. VCs are great for some types of companies, and I would always encourage folks that are starting companies to go talk to the VCs. They do this day in and day out. You want to find ones that have operational experience. You know, the guys that are Harvard Business School and McKinsey and very theoretical, those are very smart people, but you really want to find the guys that have operational experience, and that means people that have started companies and built successful companies and who've been in the trenches. And who've done it. Why do firms make strategic investments? It's a portfolio approach, meaning IBM or Oracle has a portfolio approach to their own technology offering, and they've decided that they're not going to build in a certain area like Aravo, for example. So instead of buying us, which they could also do, they're going to say, why don't we make a strategic investment in this company? We'll bring them closer. We'll bring them into the fold. They're best of breed. There's 10 companies that do what Aravo does. Aravo's the best. Let's put $5 million into their company. Let's bring them into the Blue family if it's IBM. Let's bring it into the Oracle family if it's Oracle. Pitching. This is another one of the most important bullet points in the presentation. Knowing the why and the how follows. What that means is understanding why angels invest the way they do and understanding why VCs and why companies make strategic investments completely drives how you pitch. So when you go in to get financing or to pitch a deal, you've got to understand why these folks are even meeting with you in the first place. If you just go in there and say, I've got a great idea and here it is, you're not giving yourself the best chance of getting to the next meeting. And this is a frustrating reality, but the point of every first meeting with any financing, in any financing situation, is only to get a second meeting. Because you're going to have a dozen meetings with any VCs that invest in you. So you just want to get that second meeting. And understanding why they're investing or why they're taking the meeting, as soon as you understand the why, the how is going to follow. So I think that's just something that you should really think about. Do your homework on the companies you're going to see. If you're going to see an angel, understand if they're somebody who invests deeply in this one space or if you think they're really doing it just because they like you as an individual. A lot of angels will say, I like the look in that person's eye. They really are going to make it happen. I'm going to back them. Those are the best ones because they're investing in you as a person. They don't care if you're enterprise software or hardware or, you know, IP telephony, whatever. They're investing in you as a person. If you know that, then you're in great shape. But if you don't know that and you go, you know, down a pathway of getting very technical and describing all the, you know, ins and outs of your technology, they're thinking to themselves, man, this person doesn't get it. I'm investing in them. So it's a subtlety, but it's really, really important. I've learned it over and over to understand the why and the how is going to follow. The final point on financing is you may be sitting there thinking, well, this is all great, but I don't know anybody at Goldman Sachs or I don't know any people with, you know, $1 billion to invest in my company. You might think that that's true, but by virtue of the fact that you're in this room, you already have a network. You have professors, you're at a top university. This school has an advisory board. This school has relationships with local companies. There are resources all around you, and all you need to do is spend a little time figuring out where they are and asking people to meet with you. When you're a student, and I learned this in grad school, I didn't know this in undergrad. When you're a student, you have a free pass to meet with people. You can call up people, you can find out who went to school here, who's now a business leader in the community. Call them up and say, hey, my name is Tim, and I'm a student at UCSB, your alma mater. The first thing that person's going to say is, hey, Tim, how you doing? I love UCSB. I had a great time there. You say, look, I'd love half an hour of your time. I'd love to come by and tell you about this this idea that I've got to start a company, and I know that you've started a successful company in this area. Could you possibly find a half an hour on your calendar? People love to do that. The second you graduate from school, they don't return your call. You're done. You're just another schmo out there trying to make a buck. But when you're a student, you have a hall pass. And I saw this over and over and over again. And I figured it out in business school. And I wish I had figured it out in undergrad. So if you have more questions about this topic, ask the people, ask your professors, ask your parents, ask your alumni. Talk to people around you, because the network is there. You just have to take the time to lay it out. Get a whiteboard. Lay the thing out. Figure out companies. Figure out alumni, et cetera. It's there. I guarantee you. I should probably speed this up because I figured I was going to go a little faster than I'm going. This is more financing stuff. Assessing your capital needs is key. Figure out how much money you need. At Aravo, we did 6 rounds of $2 million each, one every year for 6 years, versus doing $12 million in year one. For our capital needs, I wanted to take bite-sized pieces. Every year, do a $2 million round. I won't go into the deep details about why that is, but suffice to say, think about your capital needs and adjust your financing strategy accordingly. It's harder to go out also and get $12 million kind of out of the gate like that. So think about what your capital needs are going to be. Shop around. There's lots of money out there, but money really is cheap, and that's not supposed to be funny. That's actually true. Money, writing a check is the easiest thing that an individual, a venture capital firm, or a strategic investor is going to do. The hard part is rolling up your sleeves and doing the heavy lifting. You want people that are going to give you sales leads. They're going to give you operational support. Recruiting is a huge area where institutional investors help. Finding people is one of the hardest parts of running a company. And VCs do a great job at recruiting. So the big question you want to say is, hey, look, I've got half a dozen people that are offering me money. I want to know how you're going to help me build my company. And that's when you turn the tables. Because if you've got a hot technology or a good idea, finding the money is not the hard part. Finding people that are going to roll up their sleeves and help you build your business, that's the hard part. Sales and marketing. Start early. I did not take that advice when somebody told me that when I was a year into the company. I should have started earlier. It's never too early to start selling. If you don't have your product done, get people out there pitching betas, pitching pilot projects. It's never too early to start selling. I wish I had heeded that advice earlier on in my company's history. Direct versus channel. You can sell direct, meaning you go directly to Caterpillar and you try to sell them software. You can sell through channels, which is where you create a partnership with a company like IBM or Accenture, which is something that we've done, and you try to sell to Caterpillar through IBM or Accenture. They both have strengths and weaknesses. Just be aware that they're out there. There are different selling models out there. And you want to understand your product and whether or not it fits a direct or a channel model better. Differentiation is key. You've got to be able to explain what makes you different. There is so much noise out there in the technology market, no matter what sector you're in. You've got to understand what makes you different. In our case, there are 3 buckets of companies in our world. I'm not going to go deep into them because it would honestly probably bore you to tears, but there's data cleansing, supplier networks, and then there's us. So when I go in and people say, how are you different? I say, well, we're not data cleansing, we're not supplier networks, and here's how we're different. We're a productivity tool. And I've obviously got a lengthy story around that again would put you to sleep, but being able to summarize it very quickly in a way that resonates with people is critical. You've got to be able to differentiate. Pricing, you've got to tie pricing to value creation. I got an email while I was waiting out front there a few minutes ago that a price that we just put in for a particular project came back as too high. And that's actually good news, because what the person is actually telling me is, I want to do this deal, but the price that you've put in front of me doesn't exactly tie to the value that you're going to create for me. So all I now need to do is go back, and this is a current customer, so I actually happen to know what this guy is really saying to me. What, he's telling me, bring the price down a little bit so it's more in line with the value that you're going to create on this project. So you've got to think, you can't think about pricing from a, how much would I like to get for my product or service or my technology. You've got to understand what value it's driving for your customer, because they're not going to pay you a dime more than that. People are too smart. They understand, they understand the value that it's driving for their company, and you're going to have to price it accordingly. experienced salesperson is going to be the most important hire you make in your company. Again, I'd find that person early. Spend the most time, spend as much time as possible recruiting that senior sales exec. It's a crucial, crucial hire, and I've gone through a handful of them in my company. We've currently got a great one, and I now understand the difference between a good salesperson and a great salesperson. And you really, really want a great salesperson. I can't stress that enough. And you want to compensate that salesperson in a manner that ties to the company revenue goals. You know, salespeople are a unique breed. Most salespeople in the technology sector have very high variable compensation as a part of their comp package. So they get a base salary, and then they get commission based on sales. So you want to tie the tiers of their commission to your company's goals. In my company, I want to do $5 million in sales this year. So if my salesperson gets $5.1 million, big bonus. $4.9 million, small bonus. That's a very simplified example, but you get the picture. Quick slide on what channel versus direct is. Direct, Arabo goes directly to the companies, the clients. Channel, we go through these partners to get to the companies. Pretty straightforward, but I thought a picture might be worth 1,000 words. This is a quick look at some of the customers and partners we work with. These are our channel partners on the left. These are new clients we've sold in the middle, and this is our pipeline. From a sales and marketing perspective, you really want to understand what your sales process is. Some people call it a pipeline. I should have called it a funnel on here. That's what we actually, the term we use inside the company. Because as you funnel down from a set of leads to a closed deal, you know, you're talking about narrowing your sales funnel as you move people down through a process from qualified lead through the various steps in the process. You want to have a very clear sense of who's in your pipeline and how you're managing them, and have a sales process. I mean, this is such a cursory overview because you could spend an entire semester on this topic, sales processes and enterprise software sales. But suffice to say, as you're thinking through, and the reason I put this slide up here is because as you're thinking through what sales and marketing means for a young startup technology company, you know, this slide is the result of a lot of work, right? It's creation of channel partner relationships. I mean, creating our relationship with Accenture took me 5 years. 5 years to get to where we are today, where they've standardized on our tool set. They use us in every supplier management project they've got. It takes a long time. The new 2006 clients, each one of these came in through one of our channels, and then there's the pipeline. So just how do you break down sales? What's your sales process? Have one is the only message. I think we've just got about two more slides left, and then we'll get into some Q&A. What's your exit strategy? This is obviously the really fun stuff. Everybody wants to exit. That's the point of starting a company, right? Now, that's not necessarily true because some people may want to grow the company. You may want to have a 20 or 30-year run. You might want to run the company for the rest of your career, or you may want to sell it. It depends on you. IPO versus acquisition, it really depends on what type of company. You may be a good candidate for an IPO. You may be a good candidate for an acquisition. It really depends on the type of company. But understanding what you're shooting for is very important from the beginning. You want to have an opinion on this and build the business accordingly. If you're trying to IPO, your revenue run rate is critical. The investment banks want to see that you're doing, you know, $10 million in net income every quarter, quarter after quarter for 6 quarters in order to get an IPO. You've got to have predictable revenues and a predictable bottom line, a predictable net income number. If you're doing $1 million in Q1 and $20 million in Q2 and $150,000 in Q3 and $100 million in Q4, well, it might sound great that you just did 100 and whatever, I didn't add the numbers, $130 million that year, but it's all over the map in terms of Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4, and that's not what they're looking for. So you've got to know what your exit strategy is so that you can build your business accordingly. Acquisition, the key is to position vis-a-vis the acquiring firm. In our case, as we're looking at who might acquire us someday, IBM, Oracle, Microsoft potentially, these large technology companies, we want to understand how we fit into their world, what holes we fill in their broader offering. And this ties back to funding. You know, if you want to get acquired, the strategic investment might be good for you, right? Because you go and get a strategic investment from an IBM or from an Oracle, well, that tees you up great down the line to have a conversation with them because you're close to them, you've been building to their technology platform, you've got a great relationship with them. You're less likely to go public if you take the strategic investment funding source. So thinking about how these things kind of tie together is important. I think this is the last slide, and I put this one in here because it's just as the last slide, because it's really just so important, and it's something that we, many entrepreneurs, don't give enough credence to and think about enough. It's organizational behavior and culture. And this is really, what kind of firm are you building? What kind of firm do you want to build? What do you want people to say about your firm when they're talking to their families about where they work? What do you want the first two or three descriptive terms that people use to describe their work environment to be? Culture touches everything and everybody at the company. It's always around. And bad cultures lead to failed companies. And successful cultures lead to successful companies. If you look at some of the hallmark companies that have done a great job with culture, you look at Charles Schwab. Those guys have done a great job with culture. And it starts with Chuck. You know, talk to Chuck, that advertising campaign. It starts with him. He's one of our investors, and I've talked with him about it. And this culture is everything at that company. And it starts with an ethical leader who people want to follow. Culture is all about ethics and morals and having a very strong identity as a firm. A culture statement is a good idea. Here's who we are. Here's what we're trying to do. Goldman Sachs did a great job of that. In fact, they had their 10 business principles that were printed on everything. You saw this stuff all over the place. It was a mantra. And I remember the first one very well. And that, I mean, I was not there that long. And it shows how pervasive it was that I remember it. It said, our assets are our people, our capital, and our reputation. And of those, the third is the hardest to build and the easiest to lose. Right? Good principle. Don't go out there and do something stupid with your Goldman Sachs name tag on, because if we lose our reputation, it's the hardest thing to build back. And that was an important hallmark of their culture. Talk about your culture with your team, et cetera. That kind of goes without saying, but a lot of companies don't do it. They think because the management team has sat around and said, what kind of company do we want to be, that people get it? It doesn't work that way. You need to sit down with your people and do retreats and spend time talking about it and have a shared vision. And this is the last bullet point on culture, is that, you know, I bet you, you know, a lot of you guys who want to start companies will do it, and you'll find yourselves as a CEO someday. And you got to understand that there's a couple kinds of CEOs, and understand culturally what kind you want to be. Do you want to be the friend or the driver? And the friend is the I'm your buddy CEO. Let's be palsy, and I'm going to help support you and help set goals with you, and we're going to work together to achieve an objective. The driver is the one that says, you've got a goal, you better hit it. There's going to be hell to pay. I want you to get to this objective, and you push the people there, and you're not necessarily buddy buddy with them. I'm definitely the friend. I can't do the driver. It just isn't in my genetic makeup to sort of push that way. But some of the best CEOs in the world are drivers. One of our investors is a guy named John Mack, who's the CEO of Morgan Stanley. He's a legendary driver. His nickname is Mack the Knife. You know, he's a legendary driver, and he is called Mack the Knife because he cost cuts by cutting overhead and by cutting jobs in some cases, and he's a driver. He's the last guy that would be called the buddy-buddy style. It works very well for him. But figure out what your style is, because that's going to pervade, your culture is going to be dramatically affected by the type of CEO you are, and you can't really be both.